Good morning. I call the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present, and we'll start with the approval of the minutes for February 19, 2026. Co-Chair Schumacher, I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, and were you present? No. So we'll skip you, Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Yes.
Vice Chair Gilman moves the approval of minutes for February 19, 2026. Discussions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are now approved till February 19, 2026. Members, we have two hearings today. Number one, we'll take a little bit of a deep dive on HR 1. And then we will have a discussion with the counties. And with that, I wanted to invite the department to the table so that you can introduce yourself and proceed. Members, we have a deadline of 9:30 for the agency so that they can go to the next hearing. So we will, hopefully we'll be done before 9:30. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Noor and members of the committee. I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the Budget Director at the Department of Human Services. I'm joined by my colleague, Mary Gilbertson, who's the Legislative Budget Director in our healthcare area of the department. Today, we are going through changes to our public healthcare programs as a result of the federal HR 1 bill. And with that, we'll dig right in. All right, so HR 1 was a bill that passed on July 4th of this year, and it made sweeping changes to Medicaid. This is kind of the largest sweeping change to Medicaid since the Affordable Care Act was passed many, many years ago. These changes will be felt by all Minnesotans across the state, not just folks that rely on Medicaid for their health care coverage. As you will hear from the counties later today, these changes will impact not only folks relying on these services, but also our local governments who play a key pivotal role in administering the Medicaid program. This bill was over 900 pages long. And so at the department, we've spent many, many hours going through the bill and are currently mapping out how we would implement the many, many different provisions in the bill. Today, I'm going to go over some of the key provisions that impact Medicaid, but there are many, many other provisions in the bill that we won't touch on today. So in general, you know, these changes will result in simply a loss of health care coverage for people. Some may no longer be eligible, while others may just lose coverage because of increased complexity of the program. It will also increase uncompensated care for providers, particularly in hospitals across the state. We do know that these changes will increase complexity in accessing and administering MA. And as I said, you know, a lot of times people will lose coverage just simply because a document wasn't returned. The changes also reduce federal funding to states, and I'll go a little bit over that as we go over the provisions in detail. And then these provisions require careful planning and systems changes to implement by really, really tight deadlines that the federal government has set in play for these. So today I'll be going over work requirements, changes to six-month renewals, changes to the amount of money that folks on the program have to pay for their health care coverage, retroactive coverage periods, what the changes mean to people who are in the United States lawfully, depending on their immigration status. Some changes to the federal funding we receive as a match to the services we provide. And then there's a lot of provisions in the bill related to taxes and what states can charge for health care taxes. All right, before I dig in, you can go to the next slide. Before I dig into those provisions, I wanted to level set on what the Medicaid program looks like today. So we serve on average 1.2 million people across the state. In fiscal year 26, we're projected, as of the November forecast, to spend about $24 billion on the Medicaid program, 57% of which is funded through federal funds. The graph here splits out the amount of dollars that are projected to be spent based on eligibility category and service category. So in long-term care, we get about a 50% match from the federal government. We're projected to spend about $1.4 billion, but the number of people that we serve is about 12,000 people. So we, of course, the costs in this category are higher per person, but we serve fewer people. In the next bar is the long-term care waiver and home care service set of services. We're projected to spend about $8.9 billion. This is another area where you'll see we get about a 50% match, and we're projected to serve around 97,000 people per month in this category. The third is elderly and disability basic care. So these are, this is the eligibility category for people who are over 65 and have a qualifying disability. And these are the traditional healthcare services, excluding long-term care to that population. Again, this is around a 50% match. We serve around 193,000 people. The fourth bar is where the majority of the changes in HR 1 are impacting. So this is the category that is called Adults Without Kids, also called the expansion group. And we serve around 221,000 people, around $3.7 billion per year. But right now we get a 90% federal match for this population. So that's why you see the green in the bar graph almost covering the whole cost. The reason why this is important is because a lot of the changes that are impacted with HR 1 either shift dollars to the state, or in cases where we're seeing reduced spending, most of that reduced spending is on the federal side. And then the last graph is the Families Without Kids. This is the category that we serve most people on, 779,000 average people per month, and we get about a 50% match, but this population is a much lower cost than the other bars. All right, the next table here just shows what do we mean by Minnesota's adult expansion group. For each state, this group is slightly different, and so this just lays out who are we really talking about. All of the categories listed above the last one would not be included, such as somebody who is pregnant, children, infants, parents and caregivers, people over 65, people who are blind or have a disability. So it leaves the population who are adults who are age 21 through 64. And we'll go over a lot of the provisions just impact this category of people. The next slide just shows a map as of fiscal year 24, what percent of the population received healthcare through Medicaid. As I mentioned earlier, the changes in HR 1 will impact every area of the state beyond just the people who are relying on Medicaid and their healthcare for their healthcare. This graph shows the proportion, so you'll see in most instances, Greater Minnesota has a higher percentage of people receiving Medicaid than in other areas. The changes in this bill will not only impact those people, but the wider healthcare infrastructure in these regions. This means that, you know, in the western corner of the state, 24%, of people, that means that those hospitals and those providers have built their infrastructure around the financing around Medicaid, that any uncompensated care impacts, any reductions in people even having access to healthcare coverage will impact the whole healthcare infrastructure in these regions. All right, I'm going to dig into what specifically HR1 is having states do. So the first and likely the most impactful change to the Medicaid program is instituting work reporting requirements or community engagement requirements. This change would require applicants and enrollees who are ages 21 through 64, who do not have kids, who are not pregnant and not seeking an MA basis based on disability, also known as our expansion population, would be subject to work and community engagement requirements if they don't meet an exception. And I'll go over some of the exceptions that the law specifies. This is a tight timeline. We're required to implement this by January 1st, 2027. So we have less than a year to roll this out. In terms of the guidance that we've received thus far from CMS, we have gotten preliminary guidance. However, formal and additional guidance and rulemaking is expected and needed in order for us to fully implement this provision. In terms of a state law change that would be needed, for this requirement, we would need to change state law. And so the department is working on what those proposed changes would be. And we'd be happy to come back to the committee when we have that language. We do know that this will impact a loss of coverage and complexity in navigating eligibility for MA. We also know that it will increase the administrative complexity in terms of the experience at the counties and tribal governments in helping to determine eligibility determinations. Georgia, for example, to give an example, Georgia recently is the only state that has implemented work requirements in the past. And as of the end of 2024, research had shown that they actually spent double the amount on admin than they did on the actual healthcare that they provided people. They had way fewer people enrolling on the program than they had expected. And the research showed that it was a lot of it due to folks not submitting the correct documentation rather than them not actually being eligible for the program. Research also was conducted on whether it actually increased the work, whether people had participated in work more with that requirement in law versus not, and there was no evidence that the work requirements increased work in their state. There was also no evidence that it increased people having access to health care. So in terms of what the goals of instituting work requirements are, the research has shown that it does not actually result in the goals of that one might think that of instituting work requirements. So in terms of a financial impact, we are anticipating reduced programmatic cost. We are anticipating people dropping off of the program. Both from some no longer qualifying for MA, but also what we would call in the math the hassle factor, the fact that some people just simply will drop off because paperwork wasn't returned. We are also anticipating increased programmatic costs for individuals switching to different eligibility categories. So right now we get a 90% match for people who meet the eligibility criteria for this expansion group. But if they have a disability and don't need long-term care, they would go into that group because we get a higher federal match and they don't need to meet the higher bar of the disability and older adult category. With these requirements, somebody with a disability may choose to switch over to that category. And so we would then get a 50% match rather than a 90% match. So we are anticipating both increased programmatic costs for folks in that category, as well as increased SMRT determinations, or the determination that the department uses to determine whether somebody qualifies for MA under the category of a disability. We also are anticipating increased administrative costs, both in terms of the systems that we use. So we would have to institute all sorts of different requirements in our IT systems to be able to take in the information, to be able to track whether somebody has an exemption, and to qualify them for the program in a different way than we do today, as well as administrative costs for staffing and processing the work. So going over the qualifying activities, so this is what the law calls the work requirements activities that would enable somebody to qualify for the program. So somebody could have employment for not less than 80 hours in a month. They could also have community service for not less than 80 hours in a month. They could do work program participation for not less than 80 hours in a month, including any program that qualifies for like a SNAP work program. They could be enrolled in an education program that is at least half-time, and that half-time definition is defined by each institution of higher learning. They could have a monthly income equivalent to at least 80 hours at the federal minimum wage, which is around $580 per month. And they could have an average monthly income over 6 months equivalent to the 80 hours at federal minimum wage, and is a seasonal worker. In terms of the time period of the look back, so for initial applicants, we would be looking at the month prior to application. Do they meet these requirements? And then at renewal, we would be looking at, did they meet these requirements in one of the 6 months prior to renewal? So the law has a long list of exceptions, some of which are mandatory, some of which are optional for states. Some of these exceptions are folks that wouldn't have fallen into this expansion group to begin with. But to lay them out, to be clear, it would be people who are age 19 or under, people who are pregnant or enrolled in Medicare Part A or B benefits, foster youth, people who are enrolled in the parents and other caretaker relatives eligibility group, people who are eligible for a mandatory eligibility group who, for example, non-mandated individuals, and people who are recently incarcerated in the previous 3 months. The law also specified specific excluded people, and this is a long list. I would just note for this committee, you know, American Indians, Alaska Natives, and California Indians would be excluded. Parents and caregivers are excluded. People who are medically frail or people with a disability. People who are over 65, and I won't necessarily go over this long list, but there's a long list of exclusions that we would need to program the system to ensure that folks are excluded from the requirements. And then there's optional exclusions. So people who received inpatient care at a hospital, a person who lives in a county where there was an emergency or disaster declared by the president. There's also an optional exemption for someone who lives in a county that has an unemployment rate of 8% or 1.5 times the national unemployment rate, whichever is lower. And we do know as of today there are a few counties that would fall under that. And then a person who had to travel for extended period of time to receive medical services or treat a complex medical condition. Okay, moving on to the next provision. So 6 month renewals. Right now, Minnesota has annual renewals for the Medicaid population. This change would require states to conduct 6 month renewals for just this adult expansion enrollees who are not American Indian or Alaska Natives. Similarly, this has an effective date of January 1st, 2027. And similarly, we have received you know, initial guidance via an informational bulletin from CMS, but we have not received formal guidance from them. So we are awaiting that. In terms of whether we would need a state law change to effectuate this provision, this would need a change since in state law we have annual renewals. And the fiscal impact of this would include increased administrative costs for the state to ensure that we are checking the income and other eligibility documentation. So right now we have a requirement to hit a federal hub, for example, that would pull in info from the IRS and other standardized data that could be received by the state that would make sure that we have to do that twice per year. This item also has an exceptional amount of work and costs for our local governments. Okay, the next provision is retroactive Medicaid eligibility. So right now, Medicaid applicants will qualify for up to 3 months prior to the date that they submit their application. HR 1 changes this to limiting it to only 1 month prior to the date of application for the adult expansion populations and 2 months for all other eligibility groups. The federal law is effective January 1st, 2027. And in terms of guidance, we have received some guidance from CMS, but we are expecting formal guidance and potential rulemaking. Currently, our state law qualifies the retroactive period for up to 3 months, as I stated earlier. And so right now, what we're anticipating is that if a change to state law was not made, that those extra months would be paid in all state funds. The November 2025 forecast was updated accordingly, so that was a cost of around $12 million in the first biennium and $80 million in the second. If you were to change the state law to adjust to the federal time periods, it would simply mean more uncompensated care for hospitals and providers. It would also mean, you know, increased medical debt for low-income Minnesotans. Okay, the next provision is cost sharing in the MA expansion population. Previously, Minnesota did have cost sharing, which means that a person had, say, a copay if they were receiving certain healthcare services. That has been eliminated in Minnesota, and so this change would reinstate cost sharing in our expansion group with incomes over 100% of the federal poverty level. HR 1 did not specify what the value of the cost sharing needed to be. It just requires states to implement cost sharing with some requirements that the cost sharing could not exceed 5% of the person's income or $35 per service. It also exempted certain services such as primary care, mental health, and SUD care, as well as services provided by federally qualified health centers, behavioral health clinics, and rural health clinics. It also excluded American Indians and Alaska Natives. This one's effective October 1st, 2028. We also are awaiting formal guidance from the federal government on this provision. And in terms of how we would implement it at the state level and whether we would need a state law change, this one would definitely need changes to state law. We would need to specify what these cost sharing requirements would be. And the impact would, of course, be increased out-of-pocket costs for enrollees. We also know this provision would increase uncompensated care for providers. In the past, when we did have cost sharing, a lot of times the cost sharing was so low that it did not, it was not financially prudent for, say, hospitals to go after a $1, $2 bill, but that adds up over time. And so we do know that instituting cost sharing back into Medicaid will, in most instances, result in just more uncompensated care for providers. Another provision in HR 1 specified what legal non-citizen immigration statuses were eligible for Medicaid Currently, legal non-citizens are eligible for Medicaid coverage, but with this provision starting October 1st, 2026, that was changed for people who are age 21 and older who are not pregnant. And it narrowed the statuses to only include lawfully permanent residents, Cuban or Haitian entrants, and Compact of Free Association migrants. The people who would lose MA coverage from this provision include refugees, humanitarian parolees, asylee grantees, certain abused spouses and children, and victims of human trafficking. In Minnesota, those eligibility categories are eligible for Minnesota care largely. And so what we're anticipating with this change is that those statuses would be shifting from medical assistance to our Minnesota care program. We do anticipate a reduction in terms of the fiscal impact, a reduction in Medicaid spending, and an increase in spending in Minnesota care under the Healthcare Access Fund. There is also a change I didn't include in this slide deck, but other areas of HR 1 changed who was able to access the tax credits. And that's how our Minnesota Care program is funded. We are funded through the BHP, and we get a percentage of what that person's federal tax credit they would have gotten under the marketplace. So this change means that there's a compounding impact of having state-funded only services where previously we got a federal match for people who are residing in the country legally. Shifting to my notes. Okay, so the next few slides are going over some changes to provider taxes. Currently, regulations permit states to have a healthcare tax amount to providers of up to 6% of the taxable revenue. Minnesota, like almost every other state, does have some taxes that are provisioned to healthcare providers that help fund the healthcare programs in their state. And so what HR 1 does is it puts restrictions on these taxes starting October 1st, 2026. A state cannot impose any new or increased provider taxes that were not enacted or in effect as of July 4th, 2025. This change also phases down what that limit is. So right now we have what is called the safe harbor limit or 6% limit. For Medicaid expansion states, HR 1 requires us to decrease our maximum limit starting in fiscal year 2028 down to 3.5% in 2032. This does not apply to nursing facilities or intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities. Some different effective dates. The prohibition of new taxes became effective upon enactment on July 4th. The safe harbor limit will begin on October 1st, 2028 for that phase down. CMS has published an informational bulletin to us, and we are expecting more formal guidance and revised rulemaking as we inch closer to implementation. We do anticipate future law changes to be needed in the future, potentially related to the phase down. And in terms of impact of these provisions, there are a few impacts. Minnesota, in 2025, we passed an inpatient and outpatient directed payments, assisting hospitals to increase the amount of revenue that they can receive. This is currently at CMS for approval. And if approved, we do know that it will not be allowable after October 2026. So essentially, this will reduce the expected funding to hospitals. In 2025, Minnesota also increased surcharges for nursing homes, along with a corresponding rate increase. If approved, we do know that that will not be allowable after October 2026. And so essentially, this will result in reduced federal funding received by the state after October 2026. Additionally, once the hold harmless limit begins to drop in 2028, the state may have to lower current tax rates and potentially reduce payments to hospitals to meet that new threshold. Right now, we are doing analysis on what the end impact of that phase down would be, but that is a potential in the future. HR 1 also clarified a statistical test that is used in their approval of taxes. So currently, regulations describe the statistical test that states have to pass in order to be granted a waiver of non-uniform provider taxes. The test essentially looks at whether Medicaid providers are taxed at a higher rate than the rest of the healthcare payers. This legislation added requirements that must be met to qualify for the waiver. And tax programs that assess a rate on Medicaid revenue that is higher than other payers will not be allowed, even if the program passes the statistical test previously. This is a new requirement that was effective upon enactment. And what it means to Minnesota is the third kind of big tax provision that was passed last session was a new managed care tax that funded behavioral health care rate increases. This change ensures that that will not be approved by the federal government. Another tax-related provision in HR 1 was around state-directed payments. So state-directed payments, or SDPs, are provider payment arrangements through managed care. Currently, Medicaid rules allow states to establish state-directed payments for hospitals, nursing facilities, and academic medical centers up to the average commercial rate. In HR 1, that changed that for expansion states, stating that these state-directed payments are limited to paying only 100% of the Medicare rate. There is a different rule in HR 1 related to non-expansion states, but Minnesota is an expansion state, so that's the rule we would that would be applicable to us. The new limits were effective upon enactment July 4, 2025 for new payments. However, existing approved payments and those payments currently under review by CMS must phase down by 10 percentage points starting in 2028 until the state-directed payment is equal to the new limit. We are expecting additional guidance from CMS, and in terms of whether we need a state law change that is required for compliance, we are assessing the impact to Minnesota, and that impact is pending CMS review of some current outstanding requests that we have submitted. Another provision in HR 1 was around emergency medical assistance, or EMA. EMA covers emergency care services for people who meet the financial and other requirements for MA but are ineligible due to their immigration status. Currently, the state receives the federal match of 90% for folks that would qualify under the Adults Without Kids population. And the HR 1 changed that to our general federal match rate, which is just over 50%. This will be effective October 1st, 2026. CMS has released preliminary guidance on this. We don't need a state law change because the impact is just simply how much federal match we'll get on the back end. There's no change to the services or programs that would be provided to people, just simply what's the split between how much the state pays for the service and how much the federal government pays. Based on the November 2025 forecast, this will increase state spending by $10 million in this biennium and $39 million in the second. Another provision is around errors. So currently, Section 1903U of the Social Security Act requires each state to report the ratio of its erroneous excess payments under the state plan to its total Medicaid payments, so essentially an error rate. Payments for people ineligible for the program or overpayments for eligible people in excess of the 3% error threshold during the fiscal year are considered overpayments. Currently, we are we are allowed to work with CMS in instances where that air threshold is exceeded. CMS can waive any penalties where we are demonstrating a good faith effort to correct the payment errors. HR 1 limits CMS's authority to waive penalties for eligibility errors in excess of the threshold. It also allows CMS to apply penalties to additional audits with findings related to errors. This will be effective October 1st, 2029. States haven't received guidance to date. And in terms of how much we know that Minnesota will be impacted, that guidance will really be instrumental in terms of our ability to project what this really means for Minnesota. Another thing to note on this is there's a really big interactive effect between this item in HR1 and all the other provisions in HR1, because when we're adding complexity to eligibility criteria to the program, adding work requirements, adding six-month renewals, changing different requirements in order to access Medicaid, that adds complexity to the program. And anywhere where we don't, meet the effective dates could have an impact on this provision in terms of what any financial penalties the state will have if there are errors. This slide just goes over the timeline. So as I went over each item, you could tell that there's many different effective dates throughout all of the different provisions. Many of the provisions interact with one another, such as work requirements and six-month renewals. We have to kind of think about rolling those out in conjunction with one another. I would say most of these effective dates are really, really challenging for the state to meet, along with our county partners and our tribal partners, to make sure that we meet them. We are working with them regularly and trying to be really intentional about our work plan, and I'll go over that. So the implementation efforts. This slide just goes over our guiding principles. When the bill passed, we got right to work in terms of what are the guiding principles as we develop our work plan and implementing all these requirements. Above all else is to maintain coverage for people who are eligible for the program. Also, of course, complying with our federal and state requirements. Minimizing the burden on workforce. So at the department, we are concerned about the impact to our local governments and having to implement these new requirements. And so as we build out our work plan, we are very cognizant of the additional work on the local governments and their very strained ability to take on more workload. The next one is simplifying the process and align where possible. So we already have a system that is really challenging for people to navigate. And so we're looking to streamline as much as we can and mitigate impacts to both people and the workers at the local level. One big thing that we learned in the unwinding process is that robust communication with the people served is really, really important. And so that is a key guiding principle for us, to take those learnings that we learned on the unwinding and to incorporate the same or even better strategies to do that. And then lastly, upholding fiscal responsibility. We are concerned about that error rate requirement, and we want to make sure that we don't have future financial penalties in the future. So to implement these provisions, the things we need right now are we do need legislative authority for many of these items. So we would love to come back when we have some language on what that means and what is needed. We also need appropriations. So a lot of the work here requires additional systems work and staffing and in some cases additional appropriations for even external entities like navigators. We also need additional guidance from CMS. So for example, with the work requirements, we need guidance on what kind of documentation is really sufficient for people who are meeting that requirement for volunteer hours, for example, or what kind of documentation is sufficient for people who are seasonal workers. They may have a business doing lawn business, but They're applying in December. What does that mean if they didn't work the month prior? Another thing, I can't reiterate this enough, the timelines are extremely tight. And so we are working really, really quickly to pull together the work plan. And this means that we may have to incorporate strategies that we hadn't thought of before, such as using external vendors to meet those effective dates. And then lastly, you know, this requires multiple changes to multiple systems. Some things in our work plan include updating our policy bulletins, thinking about worker procedures and what kind of training that the counties need, solidifying additional communications and outreach plans to the people that receive services who aren't used to filling out these new documents, who aren't used to six-month renewals, for example. And all this needs to take place far in advance of when the effective date actually takes place. Speaking to large system updates, we just wanted to kind of outline some of the systems work that we need to do in order to hit the federal effective date. So with the lawful non-citizen status changes, that one is the soonest effective date of October 1st, 2026. In order to hit that, we needed to start work in December of 2025 in our systems. In order to make sure that folks continue coverage in instances where they may qualify for, say, Minnesota Care rather than MA. The work reporting requirements, effective date January 1st, 2027. Similarly, we couldn't wait until June or July in order to actually hit that effective date. And so we've been working with our Minute partners as well as the counties to design a systems work plan. And that work started in December and will go through October in order for us to hit the January 1st, 2027 effective date. Similarly with six-month renewals, same timeline. With the retroactive eligibility changes, if there were a change to state law that conformed to the federal government, we would need to start work on that in April in order to hit the deadline of January 1st, 2027. And then the cost sharing will require really complex system work because, as you can recall from that slide, it only is applicable to some populations, it's only applicable to some services, and it's indexed to a person's income. And so that's a lot of technical you know, work in the background to make sure that it's applied correctly. As I mentioned, engagement is a really important aspect of being successful in rolling out these changes. Some of the strategies we're utilizing are utilizing existing structures that the department already has in place through existing communication and governance structures to support timely awareness to people receiving services as well as our partners while maintaining alignment with our federal implementation timelines. We're also aligning our stakeholder engagement with those federal implementation timelines, creating new targeted and meaningful engagement. For example, we've started new work groups with counties and have gotten really into the weeds with them on each provision and how to roll that out in the best way possible to minimize impacts to the workforce as well as mitigate impacts to people receiving services. Another strategy is standardized messaging to promote consistent and understandable access across partners. So with all of these changes, it's easy to think that it's kind of chaos to people out there not really knowing what will occur in the program. So we're really trying to be cognizant that we're sharing information in a consistent way and that we're engaging people in an aligned and coordinated fashion. In terms of recipient enrollee outreach, again, we're trying to use strategies that we felt were pretty successful in the COVID-19 unwinding. This means collaborating and information sharing with our impacted partners, including county and tribal governments, utilizing mailings and text messages to impacted people, having a centralized webpage of changes and the actions that are needed, And then creating partner toolkits, such as one pagers and flyers, having call center scripts, having fact sheets out there, and then material for text messages and social media. All right, and I think this is my last slide, but it couldn't go without saying that the risk of noncompliance is a risk. State law changes are required to comply with many of these items. So we're hoping this session to at least come out a session with conforming changes that we need to roll out these changes and an appropriation needed to do the work. I would also state, as we may have mentioned in previous hearings, you know, CMS is monitoring the state's implementation of these new requirements. And there are other areas where they're monitoring the state, and there are financial, you know, risks in other areas, non-HR1 related. And so we are innately kind of focused on making sure that we comply with the federal timelines, that we do it successfully, and that we minimize any potential errors in the audit calculations that will eventually be rolled out as part of HR1. The last slide here, I have just a few resources. The first one is our landing page for HR1 on our DHS website. I encourage all the members and in public to go to that if you have additional questions about HR1. We also have a few interesting websites around Medicaid in general. You can go and see how many people, how many dollars are utilized in your particular region of the state. So I would encourage you to look at that and understand how your particular community is impacted by Medicaid. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Director Crum. We have got a couple of questions. We'll start with Representative Murphy, followed by Co-Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. With regard to the Medicaid error rates, the threshold is 3%. Where are we today, and what will it cost the state if we continue at the same pace and we don't get it down?
Director Bailey.
Chair Norr, Representative Murphy, my understanding is that in our most recent audits, we were much below the 3% threshold. We are awaiting guidance on what audits they're actually looking at. There's many different audits, so there may be some caveats to that. I would say that any increase over 3% is a lot of money. For example, if we had a 3.1 error rate, it would be $20 million to the state budget. And so that's kind of what we're focused on is the threshold, the amount of money of the penalty is exceptionally large, even if you go just slightly above the
3%. Thank you, Ms. Bailey.
Representative, just wanted to add on that. You talked about the recent report for PAM, which is Payment Error Rates Measurement, that we get from the federal government that was just announced. It was 2.1% compared to the national average of 6.1. Is that correct, Director Bailey?
Chair Norr, I don't have. Did that sound correct?
I have the report. It shows 2.1.
Yes, okay. Chair Norr, yes, that is correct. Thank you.
6.1%. So we are way below the national average compared to the other states. Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair. Where were we a year ago? My understanding, we were at about 6%, and that would have cost us about $315 million. Did we drop from 6% to 2.1? And if so, how did we do that?
Chair Norr, Representative Murphy, I'd have to get back to the committee. I apologize. I don't have that information. My understanding is generally we've been under that threshold, and there are different error report, different populations. My understanding is it's not just one report. They're looking at several different items. But I can get back to the committee on the history in the last several years.
One more question.
Representative Maff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. You talked about less Medicaid spending would actually result in more cost to taxpayers because of the administration burden that's on implementing the program. When people are working, so the 21 to 64-year-old group, Once they're working, what's the continued cost if they stay working?
Director Bailey.
Chair Knorr, Representative Murphy, are you asking what is the continued cost on Medicaid?
I guess what I'm asking is, I know that there might be an administrative burden to get in, but the long-term picture, if that group is not part of our cost, how does that weigh itself out after time?
Chair Knorr, Representative Murphy, we do know nationally that already a huge percentage of Medicaid enrollees are already working. I think it's around 71%, then an additional, I think 10 or 11% are going to school, and an additional like large percentage are older adults and people with disabilities. So we're talking about a very small percentage of the population. When I looked at the research from Georgia, for example, there was no evidence that it actually increased workforce participation in their state. And so in terms of our numbers where we're projecting impacts to Medicaid, we aren't projecting that this would result in a higher workforce participation.
Representative.
One more quick one. With regard to that adult group 21 to 64, when do you think you'll have those updated in the system? Is it a six-month process? Is it a three-month process? How long will it take you to go through that?
Director Bailey.
Chair Knorr, Representative Murphy, what we are planning right now is to start work in the summer on identifying who of that population is excluded. So if we'll look at like data sources that we already have, so what data sources are showing people are already within either work or have some of the exclusions that were laid out. From there, then we will have to do outreach to each enrollee to see if they meet the requirements, and that will be months-long processing. And so we won't know who meets that requirement and who does not, likely until shortly before we roll this out in January 2027.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. I've got most of my questions revolve around the question of the work reporting requirements and the population it impacts. We were talking about the people ages 21 to 64. Wondering how that applies when you've got people who are homeless. You know, when I take a look at the homeless population, you've got many things that contribute to that, where people might be struggling with substance use disorder, mental health, et cetera, but not to the level where it's a disability. So are we taking a look at most of these, you know, how does that population look? Does that mean a number of those folks who are currently covering would then lose their coverage?
Director Bailey.
Chair Knorr, Representative Fisher, I don't have specific details on that, but I would say that is a worry of ours. Just not only would they not meet, say, the work requirements, but would they get the letter in the mail, right? So those are the items we're kind of working through, and how to reach the hard-to-reach populations. That's why we're kind of working with the counties and thinking about how we could utilize an external vendor to try to mitigate exactly that impact that you're detailing.
Representative.
Thank you. And so if, knowing the characteristics of the population, it's very challenging for them. And that's one of the big barriers we have, is not only having the documents, but for those that occasionally do work from time to time, is for them to try to get those documents turned in. So if they end up without coverage, that sounds like it's going to be an additional burden onto the hospitals for additional uncompensated care, usually through the emergency room. So in some ways, that's going to even increase the strain on our healthcare system that they're currently experiencing. How does it also apply to those who might have retired early and, say, went on Social Security at 62? So if they're not working on Social Security at 62, how does that apply, the work requirements apply to that population?
Director Bailey.
Chair Knorr, Representative Fisher, that's a great question. I would have to get back to you, but I personally have not seen any exemptions that would detail that population unless they had a qualifying disability.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Thank you for mentioning that. And that is a concern because I know people, a number of people who have fallen into that category where because of the demands of the job they had over time, they are just physically or mentally not able to continue working. And so as a result, they took Social Security earlier. So they're already in that instance, they're on Social Security. Now you're saying, oh, you're on Social Security, but you have to go to work to be able to get health care. It just seems very contradictory to our system out there. So just a comment, but thank you.
Representative Ganda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a question about folks who would maybe lose their MA coverage and then would have to go on maybe Minnesota Care or some other type of plan. At that moment, if we start to see large numbers of that, are you going to be able to come back to us then as policymakers? Because that's another decision point, I believe, right? But the current policy may have to be revised if there are large numbers of people coming off of MA and onto Minnesota Care. We have to preserve that healthcare access fund and other, you know, because we have other uses for that money. So that would be my first question is when you start to see that happen, if there are large numbers of people who would make that shift, at that point, are you prepared to come back to us as policymakers to consider, okay, what do we want to do with that?
Director Bill.
Chair Knorr, Representative, I love that question. Yes, we would definitely. We will be tracking this. One thing that we learned under the unwind, where we had to re-enroll essentially the entire population. One of the key strategies we had was tracking it really in a detailed way. We were tracking people by county, by different population, and deploying strategies in instances where, you know, there may be, you know, trends that we're seeing in the wrong way in certain areas of the state or in certain populations. So we would definitely be doing data analytics around what is the impact of these changes. Now, it may be challenging to say it's only because work requirements. It may be more global, like because of all of these changes that are occurring at the same time, and there's definitely interactive effects between and compounding impacts between each of them. But we will certainly be doing analytics and would be happy to come back and share that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One little follow-up. With that analysis, would you please be ready to come back also? Let's say we're at the crossroads. They could either go on to a Minnesota Care type product, or if that were not available, what if they go to the ACA marketplace, right? Apart from that, if that, say, went away, not to say it would, but if it did, what would be the difference then in premiums that they would pay and also coverages that they would get in those two scenarios?
Chair and our representative, I'm not sure whether we can track a person once they fall off our system. So we know that they lost coverage in MA or Minnesota Care, but we may not be able to join the data of that person to another data set such as at Minsure or the commercial market. We may not know that, hey, this person got employer-sponsored coverage, for example. So it may be a more challenging analysis to join that and know really the reasons why they fell off.
Mr. Chair, one last, so even proactively on that, right, before an individual did fall off, just make a kind of a general application to that so we could know if someone fell off, what would they encounter in the marketplace? That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Right, Chair Knorr, Representative, I will connect with our folks to see if that's some data we can try to collect on the front end.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director Bailey. So as I'm hearing you go through all of these different requirements or mandates from the federal government, I'm also hearing that the state of Minnesota is struggling to sort of ensure that we have the correct data that we need to make the right decisions and do so in an efficient way. Do you see this in any way connected to the needs that the state has to significantly upgrade the IT systems that DHS is using?
Director Bill.
Chair Knorr, Representative, absolutely. You know, we are implementing these provisions somewhat from a deficit in terms of the status of our IT platforms. If we had a more modernized system to begin with right now, we would be able to be more agile and could maybe implement things in a quicker way and mitigate impacts to people. So yes, we are absolutely hindered by the current status of our IT infrastructure.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Director Bailey. I think as we go through these conversations again on both sides in this committee, I think it's been made pretty clear that the state, that DHS doesn't necessarily have the resources they need, not only to conduct the business that we're requiring from the state level, but to conduct business or to adhere to mandates from the federal government that we're not getting funds for either. So I would just encourage this committee that as we listen to all of these conversations, that we consider what jumping into an investment in IT could look like for the state of Minnesota, and consider what the savings in the future might look like if we're able to, you know, it's going to be expensive in the beginning, but we could really look at some huge savings, I think, in the future with some investments in IT. Regardless if folks agree with the policies in front of us and the requirements in front of us, I think that still speaks to how we need these IT upgrades. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Director Bailey. I would love to circle back. You mentioned the re-enrolling that you had to do, the unwinding and then the re-enrolling. Did we ever hear back from you how many people were receiving benefits that weren't eligible to receive benefits in that unwinding process?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative Gilman. Yes, so to level set, in case not everyone knows what the unwinding was, but during the federal emergency, we were instructed or required by the federal government to keep people on the program. With that, we got an enhanced federal match. Once the federal emergency was declared done, we then had to do the unwinding process, which meant we had to re-enroll or check each person's eligibility. My memory is that prior to doing the unwinding, we had about 1.3 million people on the program, and right now we have about 1.2 million on the program. I would say that folks that dropped off, we don't know whether they simply are not eligible, that they maybe don't meet the income requirements or other requirements of the program, or if they got other coverage, or they just didn't turn in the paperwork. So I wouldn't necessarily say that incremental population is not eligible. We just know that right now we're serving 1.2 million, and prior to that it was around 1.3, I believe.
Representative Gill.
Thank you. All right, thank you for that. I would like to just talk about really quick complying on page, what was it? Well, the guiding principles for implementation. Chair Noor, I would love to ask the question for Director Bailey on, like, I think you said, I heard you say, if we comply to this implementation, I just want to know, why wouldn't the state of Minnesota want to comply? Why wouldn't we want to be compliant to what the guidelines are going to be?
Chair Noor, Representative Gilman, thank you for asking the question. I must have misstated. We are frantically working on complying.
Okay.
I think maybe the caveat to that is we need legislative changes in state law to implement many of these provisions. So that is a caveat. Like, if we don't have a bill this year, if we don't have an appropriation to do it, we will be hindered to meet those effective dates. But in terms of desire to comply, we are frantically working on doing that.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. And I would like to touch on the IT piece of it. I've heard you mention also that we are, you keep asking, saying we are, meaning is it DHS or the counties? Since the counties are implementing, again, I'll go back to the green screens, they're the ones that are deeming the eligibility. They're the ones that are going to have the extra requirements, and we'll hear from them later. Are you also saying DHS needs IT enhancements, or when you're saying we need IT enhancements, are you saying you know, both the counties and DHS so they're more compatible? Or are you saying DHS?
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative Gibbon, the systems that determine the eligibility are run at the state level. And so any changes to, say, MMIS or METS would need to be appropriated to DHS, and we will be working with the counties in terms of how to prioritize those changes to comply with HR1. The counties may have other systems, such as, like, case management type, you know, tracking cases that aren't held by the state, and they may want to speak to what their specific IT needs are. But in terms of the actual IT programs that run eligibility, that is held at the state level.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for this presentation. I want to bring us back to people because I'm really concerned about people who become disabled and what that means. And so I'm particularly worried about people who have strokes between 55 and 64. It's super common. People have strokes. And most people think that when that happens, they'll be fine. What they don't know is that most of the time, stroke recovery is 6 to 9 months. The other thing they don't know is that you can't apply for Social Security disability after a stroke until a year. Many people also don't know that Social Security has a mandated 5-month wait to apply. So you're not eligible for Medicaid, even if you qualify for Social Security after the stroke for 24 months, because that's your Medicare requirement. So I just want to sort of, like, put that into the universe. And HR1 talks about if you are disabled. And so a stroke, in theory, would be that. The problem is the process of getting to being disabled is super complicated. I don't know if Director Bailey or her colleague knows this. What is the average SMRT wait time right now for a certification? Is it still at 9 to 12 months?
Chair Noor, Representative Hicks, I don't know an updated.
Well, last cycle when you came and asked for money for SMRT, you told us 9 to 12 months. So I'm going to use that data point for this point. So the SMRT process is 9 to 12 months. Social Security is 18 to 24 months. You're not eligible for Medicare until 24 months. In that wait time, we may be able to put you on MA, depending on how long it takes to get through that process. Also, depending if you know how to navigate the SMRT process. I would hasten to guess that nobody sitting around this table knows who starts the SMRT process. Did you know you can't just start it? You can't. There's a special form, and the only people who can submit the form is your county. There's also a way to do it online, but do you know how many cases are pending right now in the system just in the 7-county metro? It's like 772 or something. Like, it's an absurd number of cases that haven't even gotten to the SMRT team's desk. So you are 55 years old, 56 years old. You have paid into your taxes your entire life. You have paid your Social Security premiums. You have done all of the right things, and you had a stroke. And now you are stuck in the hospital, and your COBRA is going to run out. You can't afford it because you don't have a job, because you can't go back to your job. Social Security says you have to wait a year to apply after a stroke because of recovery time. You're burning through your 401k. You're burning through your savings. You can't figure out how to get on medical assistance. And now we're telling you, you got to work 80 hours a week or you're not going to have that option either. It's super fun. I love it so much.
Chair Noor.
Director Bailey, if you can also explain what is SMRT. You know, many people may not understand.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Noor, Representative Hicks. Yes. Thank you for bringing up the SMRT process. SMRT is the state medical review team. A process where if somebody has a disability and they're applying for MA under the disability status and they don't have disability declared currently under the Social Security Administration, the state Medicaid agency through the SMRT process can do that work. As Representative Hicks very clearly lined out, that is a time-intensive process, and we do have wait lists or, you know, wait times and for us to get it to them. I agree with you, Representative Hicks, in terms of the changes in this bill will exacerbate an already kind of stretched system in terms of the SMRT processing. It will impact not only people that are, say, trying to get an exemption from the work requirements because they do have a disability, but it will also impact the person you just lined out, a new person trying to apply for the program, or, you know, somebody, the entire program will be kind of put under a large amount of stress because we will have more requests for SMRTs than we likely have ever had in the past. I would also say that this is one key area where we are awaiting guidance from the federal government on what is the definition of medically frail. Will somebody get an exemption only through the SMRT process, or are there specific conditions that could make them exempt from those work requirements? And so that is yet to be known, and we are anxiously awaiting the answer to that.
Quick one, Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I am hoping we get some guidance on medically frail. I just, as most of you know, I'm from Rochester. And so we have quite a rehab facility at the Mayo Clinic, a stroke facility. People fly in all the time. And in my other life, prior to being in the legislature, I helped Mayo brought those people to the nonprofit that I worked at for help trying to figure out how to navigate this system. And so I have sat in an office with so many amazing, hardworking Minnesotans from all over the state, particularly stroke, because Mayo has a really good stroke program, stroke patients who were just devastated. And I'm really worried because it was bad before, and I'm concerned that we don't have guidance on medically fragile. And I know how difficult the system is to navigate, particularly when your whole life has been turned upside down. And so I'm just so worried about this population of newly disabled folks after this process goes into place, because they're already struggling to access healthcare and resources. And so I'm so worried about what that looks like. And so I appreciate you highlighting that. And if you hear about medically fragile definitions, how will we get that information? Because I want to make sure we get that out to community as soon as possible once we have it from the federal government.
The last question from Representative Kill, and then we'll move to the counties.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple questions, but they're clarifying questions, so hopefully they're quick, or if you could get some information to us. I know that we can look online, but there's some things I just want on the record. So the population served, I know that you have percentages. The northwest corner of the state, which is the side of the state that I live in, is 24%. Can you tell us how many people that is? Because I think it's important, like we always talk about dollar signs and percentages, but I think it's important for us to just name how many people are we serving, and like what does that look like for a rural region? The other question I have, you don't have numbers on the slides, but it's the one that's legal non-citizen MA eligibility on here. So as somebody who has worked really hard in protecting victims of violence, sexual assault, sex trafficking, I just need this impacted people portion to make a little more sense to me. It says certain abused spouses and children. Can you clarify what that means or who is not covered in that? And then I just want to make sure where it says victims of human trafficking, we're also including sex trafficking, that there's nothing that's saying that our sex trafficked victims are not still covered. And then I do have one follow-up question after that.
Director Bailey.
Chair Noor, Representative Keeler, my understanding, sorry, we maybe generalized the slide. My understanding with this change, the only people that will be eligible for MA under legal immigration statuses who are age 21 and older are permanent residents, the Haitian migrants, and the COPA. all the other statuses for people who are in the country legally with legal immigration statuses who are 21 and older will not be eligible for Medicaid. So the sum may be excluding kids or pregnant people. But in general, if you're 21 and older, you will not be eligible for MA. In terms of scope, we are doing assessment on like how many people are we talking about here. And the data that we have is somewhat challenging because right now they're eligible, so we don't track when a status changes, for example. So it could be anywhere between about 4,500 and 7,000 people that are impacted in that group.
Representative Campbell.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director. So the other question I have is there's a lot of fiscal impact that's coming on to the state. We're one of few states that's county ran, state supervised. We know that there's a different financial flow that falls down to our counties. We also always see the counties come to our table and try to figure out how to offset the cost that now we put on the counties. So can you tell me a majority of these fiscal impacts that are noted on here, how much of that is just assumed that it will transition down to the county's responsibility to fund those adjustments, or is that all at the state level in the general fund?
Director Bailey.
Thank you for that question, Chair Noor, Representative Keeler. At this point in time, it was kind of awkward, to be frank, to put some costs in this PowerPoint for some provisions, and then in other provisions we have no costs. That's because some items that don't have, say, a state law change needed, we assumed in the forecast we would be able to implement those. And so those are the only provisions that we indicated a cost, and that's the cost to the state budget. But there will be a lot of other costs when we have, say, the governor's budget come out and we have our proposal on, say, how we would implement cost sharing, how we would implement work requirements. And those costs will be the cost of the state. In terms of the costs counties will incur, I think that's a good conversation that we all need to have in terms of what it really means for them. In our work plan, we are, I think I mentioned it a few times, but I wasn't directly presenting on it, but we are assessing pulling in an external vendor for the work requirements so that the counties aren't doing 100% of all of this new work. That we have more resources at the state level to A, make sure that we are excluding everyone that has an exclusion, B, that we are excluding everyone who from automatic data sources we can already see that they're working the threshold, and then C, that small population that doesn't have an exemption and we don't have external data sources that can prove that they meet the threshold, that we're helping the counties at the state level work with those enrollees so that it all doesn't kind of pile on the counties. Even with that, I would say the counties will incur much more costs because they're still having six-month renewals and they're still having to interact with us in terms of information flow for even the work requirements. So I'm interested to hear from them on how they kind of define those costs. But thank you for asking the question. It's kind of half information in this deck, and hopefully we can come back at a later date with more totals on the impact to the state budget.
Representative Keeler, I know that we've run out of time, and Director Bailey has to be in a different hearing. Go ahead. All right, thank you so much, Director Bailey. I'm sure this question is not coming to an end, so we will be back on these questions as we proceed. So thank you so much. The next group to testify will be the counties on the impact of HR 1. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Noor, members of the committee, my name is Paul Verrett, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators and also the Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'm joined by Barb Dahl, Human Services Director, Scott County, and Angela Youngerberg from ALY Strategies, and someone with many years of experience in these issues, and which she can tell you more about. I'm going to quickly let you know what it is we're going to be talking to you about today, and then we'll launch into more detail about the impacts of HR 1 on counties, which, as you've already heard from our state partners, is considerable, urgent, and happily some mitigation has already started. but the impacts are going to become increasingly urgent. The first thing that we want to get across is that our workload and county cost increases are going to be severe. And then that also, the next impact I want to talk about is to our residents. There are continuing threats to continuity of care for our most vulnerable residents. And as you know, in our system, the counties and our caseworkers are very close to those residents. It's not a metaphor when we say that we're working for our neighbors in a lot of cases, especially in our rural communities. The counties are extremely close to the people we serve, and that goes for both our staff and commissioners. I wanted to remind you, as already been mentioned, the green screen. I just want to say a little bit about the IT context and the capacity context of what we're talking about today. The state systems used to support Medicaid, and this also applies to the state systems used to support other benefits. We won't be talking about SNAP in this hearing, but that is another one where our county workers are going to have feel considerable impacts. The systems that we use, the example that we have given so often is that they operate, some of them, on green screens. It's a series of disconnected databases that are incredibly inefficient, difficult to use. They use command prompts. You've already heard, I think, this session at least once, one of you mentioned Oregon Trail. And it's a system that impacts our staff and impacts residents in application processing timelines and many other important things. The mitigation that we're going to talk about, the immediate and long-term commitment to technology modernization is absolutely crucial, and it requires continuation of a strong state-county partnership and collaboration. And now I'm going to go ahead and move over to Angela Youngerberg, who can reintroduce herself and get started on details.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Knorr and members of the committee. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am a consultant with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, known as MACSA. Previously, I have been with you in a prior capacity working with counties, specifically Blue Earth County. I've worked with counties for over 20 years in my career in human services. My colleague just shared the importance of collaboration when we are undertaking this level of change. And on the slide, you will see a structure that has been put together by the counties and the state. Beginning last summer, the counties approached the state and said, we are approaching some quite high priority items that change really the face of human services in Minnesota. And this is a very, very simple diagram of what is a very complex collaboration that's occurring between the counties and the state. And it's centering around three topics: long-term services and supports, SNAP, and Medicaid. We're here today to talk about Medicaid. But as Director Bailey indicated, she uses the term interactive effect. And that happens in policy, but it also happens in programs. And as counties are looking at all of these three major things, in addition to everything else in human services, this is a time of significant, significant change. So we appreciate being here today. In this structure, there are top-level leadership and very critical roles from both counties, including human services directors and commissioners, as well as leaders and critical roles from the Department of Human Services, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and now we've included MINUT in these conversations, and that has enhanced the level of discussion that we're able to have, which has been great. Next slide. Director Bailey really did the heavy lifting this morning, and I won't be going through this slide in detail. These are, of the many things that she outlined, these are the five areas of top priority and focus on the part of counties. And so within that structure, we are diving deep into the weeds on all five of these areas. A Again, this is not an exhaustive list, and the primary focus and mission on the part of counties administering Medicaid is to determine eligibility. So we are the front line. We are the faces that people see and the people that and people who talk to regarding eligibility. This list also does not illustrate the impacts to the SNAP program, as my colleague indicated earlier, we won't be going into detail on, but there are serious and significant changes happening in SNAP. The same workers at the county level are navigating many, many changes at the same time with SNAP and Medicaid. We already know that policy is very, very complex in these areas, and we are adding additional workload to navigate this. I'll talk about this one a little bit. The Medicaid expansion group that Director Bailey talked about is the group that's going to be seeing the most change in here. And we're estimating approximately 200,000 people will be impacted. If we look at the more frequent Medicaid eligibility determinations, just want you to consider that the county worker was doing those eligibility determinations once per year. They're now having to do them twice. So they're touching 200,000 more cases per year in order to determine eligibility. Again, the work requirements are significant, and it was referenced this morning, the work that the state is doing in that regard, and we are definitely quite engaged in that whole process. And notably, and also commented, was the new penalty in the form of a benefit cost share that will apply to states who have a payment error rate above 3%. Minnesota's rate is 2.1%. And so we are very mindful and focused on making sure that the changes that happen at the state and county levels do not hinder that rate. But that will hinge very much on the ability of the technology to be changed to the current policies. So as we do this work together, themes have emerged. Oh, go ahead, next slide. And the themes that I want to talk with you about today, these are not all of them, but we are definitely focused on the people, focused on minimizing any negative impacts to recipients and to working with our partners, hospitals, providers, our community providers. This is significant work. And we understand that the result of this may result in increased uncompensated care. Our part on that is to make sure that we do eligibility determinations well. One thing with the systems is that when policy changes are made, system changes have to happen and have to match that. And if for some reason the state is not able to do that, whether it's resourcing, technology limitations, or any other reason, what has to happen at the local level is called a workaround. So the county worker has to manually go in and change the system and make changes to make sure that that eligibility determination is correct. For example, we received a change process regarding SNAP eligibility just this last week. The presentation to county staff was extensive. It was 37 pages of technical change to be able to force the system to work so that the worker can determine eligibility. We are hopeful that we have a little bit longer timeline with Medicaid, although not long really at all in the grand scheme of things, that more of that will be automated than what we're seeing on the SNAP side. If I can leave you with anything, workarounds, although they may be necessary if the state cannot change the system, workarounds equal errors because we're introducing the human element in that process. Workarounds equal increased county costs because that's more time that the county worker is having to spend to do that. We also want to support the DHS announcement of working with a third-party vendor for community engagement. This is simply something that county staff cannot take on, that manual work to do that. So the engagement with a third-party vendor is essential, and it is something that counties highly support. Lastly, we've stated this all along, counties are heavily reliant on the successful implementation of all of these new policies and procedures for HR1 so that the state is not financially penalized under the payment error rate. And so we will continue to work, as we've shown in the diagram, working collaboratively with our state partners. Thank you for your time, and my colleague will share more on what this looks like at the county level.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair Knorr, and members of the committee for allowing us time today to give you a little more detail as to how this is impacting counties and our workload. So as we've heard today, HR 1 is really creating historic fiscal and operational challenges at the county level. It brings major changes to our Medicaid eligibility, work requirements, and redetermination timelines. And it's just amount of complexity and an urgency in the work that is really putting tremendous amount of pressure on our staff. The challenge really just isn't about the work volume, but as we've heard today, it is about the systems in which we are working in. As we just talked about the manual workarounds, it creates significant risk, and those risks really boil down to cost at the county level, cost to staff morale, and our ability to keep and retain staff. We want to give you a concrete example. So METS is actually the system that we determine eligibility in for Medicaid. But if you pull out one example of an area where we need to do workarounds, it's if somebody actually has a baby while they are a client on the case. We actually have to close the case and re-enter that entire case over again, and that can go anywhere from 45 minutes to 2 hours just for that. So that's just one example, one situation, but take that times thousands and you get an idea of the type of workarounds that we're having to deal with. And then you add the complexity and the layers of work onto it that HR1 brings, and it becomes really an unsustainable piece for all of us. In addition to that, we talked about SNAP already, and that these are sometimes the same teams, sometimes the same departments, sometimes the same worker in our smaller counties that are doing both SNAP and Medicaid. And so we already know that the potential for cost related to Medicaid for SNAP could be significant. For the administrative share, you're looking at over $30 million to counties. For the cost-benefit share, it could be over $90 million, unless this session helps to mitigate that for counties. So what do we do to help succeed as we move forward? One, in the state response that they had just outlined regarding some of the significant systems changes that need to take place, they need to be done in order to try to get a handle on this work. In addition to that, counties need what we're calling bridging supports. These are short-term tools that stabilize operations while we think through and hopefully develop a longer-term modernization strategy. Within the bridging solutions, we're looking for things like having counties have access to our own data, and tools like the work number and asset verification to help with program integrity and policy consolidation so that we have one consistent place to look for all of the rules and regulations that it takes to administer these programs. These fixes are really achievable now. We have counties that are taking the lead on this, but we just need to do this in a way that allows us to make a difference on our accuracy and program integrity. We also need a long-term modernization plan that moves Minnesota towards an integrated platform with centralized core functions, a system where eligibility workers are not bouncing back and forth between 30-year-old green screens and siloed systems, manual processes, and scattered policy resources, but a long-term system that builds out and supports the HR1 accuracy demands that it requires. This will allow us to hopefully meet the payment error pieces that are demanded of us and hopefully allow us to have consistent service delivery. Finally, we need program simplification, streamlining policies and procedures, again, to help support that accuracy and efficiency. One piece that I really also want to highlight is just our workforce needs. The counties are already struggling to recruit and to retain a qualified workforce. If we continue operating with outdated systems and manual procedures and workarounds, we just do not have enough staff to meet these requirements, and we are going to need additional resources to support this work. Counties are committed to program integrity and to serving the people of Minnesota, but we can't meet the demands of HR1 with outdated systems and manual workarounds. Modernization, supported by short-term bridging relief, program simplification, and long-term investment is essential for us to fulfill the responsibilities placed on counties and to safeguard our clients and Minnesota's healthcare system. thank you for your time and your partnership.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I know many of my colleagues have got questions. We have 10 minutes, so we'll get started with Professor Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for being here today. Wish we had several hours to talk about this, but we don't. But I would love to do some more things offline, and I appreciate you coming in. I just want to go back to, I think, Barb, you were talking about like when a mom is expecting a baby, her services go up, correct? She would be then, like, let's say she's getting $1,000, she would be then, when you're expecting a baby, you would get $2,000 a month. Is that correct?
Like, who's going to take
Chair Noor, Representative Gilman. So it would be based off the capitation rate for that household. And so once they would need additional, so if we're talking about medical assistance, then the capitation rate would increase based off the household size. If you're talking about SNAP, then the SNAP would increase as well based off household size.
Thank you so much, Chair. So one thing that I remember when I was over at a county just seeing how everything worked and spending hours over there is there is not in the system an opportunity to know that after 10 months that mother is then on normal, like a different scale of benefits, like her pre, what she came in with versus having a baby. So it's like doubled. And so then that would be on there for 17 months. So then again, that makes... goes back, the cost goes back to the county as well as, you know, it's so I do believe the IT piece of it is huge to have systems in place that if we know when a mother is expecting and when her delivery is, that it would not go 17 months. So you're saying you have to manually go in and change it. Otherwise, that extra money is going out the door after the baby is already here.
Director Bell.
Yeah, Chair Noor and Representative Gilman, I think anything that we can do to enhance our notification system that helps support system modernization, I think will help frame up both a service delivery and a cost perspective. So I think we would be happy to get more specifics if that's helpful on that specific cost piece. But I think that there are a lot of areas that we can help shore up the work of both our workers and fiscally.
So thank you, Chair. My last question is, have you engaged with the other 9 states that do the work that you do? And are they using third-party vendors for their systems, their review systems, or do they have in-house IT?
Ms. Yangab.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative Gilman. Yes, we have been engaging through the National Association of Counties, NACO, with the other states that are state-supervised, county-administered states. Learning, we actually meet monthly, twice a month at times, to learn what the other states are doing. It has been, at this point, given all of the rollout with HR1, the focus has been on SNAP more than Medicaid at this point because SNAP is on a much tighter time frame. I can say that there are vendors out there that other states are looking at using and other mm-hmm. states have used for this type of work verification process. So it is not necessarily a new concept, and I do not think that we are alone in that pursuit as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, counties. Paul, it's good to see you here. Saw you in the homeless world for a long time, so glad to see you move over here. With Gilman on the fact that we do need IT, but I get really nervous, and I think we're going to question a third-party vendor tomorrow a little bit about some cautions and some things that we're learning about that. So I'm with you in needing some outside support. I just want us to be very, very mindful, particularly because this is information that we just want to be careful with. I want to just ask a couple questions about the workload and potential burnout that we're putting on the, especially our rural communities. Like, what is the average caseload that a county worker has? Like, how many people you talk about we're going to add extra work for them? So I'm interested in what their caseloads look like from a geographic spread. Are our rural communities, just because they're much larger, is there a disadvantage or a larger impact that you guys are seeing with all of this? Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Dahl.
Chair Knorr, Representative Kaler, I will say, just speaking for Scott County, our caseload sizes for those that are in the medical assistance can run anywhere from 700 to 800. Some counties choose to do things different and do like a case banking model, so it can vary across the counties on how their makeup and their configuration and the size of county. Like, they might have mixed caseloads with SNAP and Medicaid if they're a smaller county as well. But I will say, like, even if I ask our staff, if we look at just the twice a year redeterminations, and we have about 31,000 people that are on Medicaid at any given, over the course of a year in Scott County, about 3,500 that are going to be a part of this, your single adult group that is going to be most impacted. And so when I asked one of our managers, what do we think this is going to take staffing wise, she said, if we don't have any additional resources that are added to this, this is going to be about 2 to 3 more people just for us. So that's about 130 people across the state of Minnesota. That's where we have to think through, how do we have our systems help support this work? Because that it's a workload that we can't really afford to bring on right now.
Representative Kim.
Thank you, Chair. I know I've talked to caseworkers in my side of the state, and they're really close to burnout. I think we saw this in education. We saw this in nursing when there's these massive changes to their workload. Do you think that that statement is correct, or are you guys also hearing, I don't need like a number or data on it, but are you guys hearing, sort of feeling the same thing? Because what I get worried about is, as we do this ripple effect of change, and we know we're already having a hard time just getting people to move and live and work in our communities, that if this is going to create an increase of need of humans to do this work, what is our plan to make sure that we have young people and young professionals coming out to our communities to continue to do work like this if the workload is so grueling?
Mm-hmm. Director Fidel.
Yeah, Chair Knorr, Representative Kaler, I will say that the burnout is true. I think that it is becoming more challenging to do the work. I will say communicating, I think, the collective push to try to make change, and knowing that the Association of Minnesota Counties and many of you have taken interest in our state systems, helps. It offers a piece of hope on that we maybe can think through a different way through maybe some really challenging times.
Representative Kim.
Representative Keeler, the one thing I would like to add to my colleague's answer is that one of the first things we see is retention. And so even getting to the point where they are having careers long enough where they get to the point of what we consider burnout, we're not even getting to that point in some cases. I'm hearing our members saying that it can take a caseworker up to 2 years to feel like they are completely comfortable with the system. So even after we have to first get them to that point, and then we also are managing the burnout.
Thank you for that. I think I just want to make sure that we remember the people who are working in the industry of love. I know that there's fiscal impacts. I know that there's, you know, the service impact, but there's a group of people here that are really important that I just don't want us to miss. And I think often the people who work in, like I say, the industry of love just really get pushed to their limits, and they're doing just great work in the community. So thank you to everybody who's continuing to do the work and staying as we make these adjustments. That's it, Chair. Thanks.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 5 seconds or less. When the topic of upgrading this technology has come up in the past, talking to my legislative colleagues, the answer is always, didn't we set aside money for that? Didn't we allocate money for that? So what I would like to see, and maybe anyone could weigh in on it, and I'm not volunteering, but I'd like to see a work group that includes someone from the legislature, someone from DHS, and someone from the county that can wrap around and actually bring some accountability to this whole process. Because it feels like a logjam, and I don't think it's just a money logjam. I think it's almost like people don't know where to start. How do we initiate this thing and get it to go? So to clear the logjam, it isn't just the money, let's find some consensus. What does this even look like? Is there someone out there already doing it, another vendor that could just plug in? So I think that kind of effort, a work group that consists of our agency, our counties, someone from the legislature to break the logjam. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds like you're the chair of
September. Oh. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I know we're running out of time, but also wanted to mention, because of the system challenges, the error rate for SNAP program is almost 9%. That is going to cost us $86 million because of the penalty, that 10% of the benefits which we're going to be paying. So put in mind, if we do a good job, we're going to be saving $86 million from the other side. So with that, I think we don't have any other items. I just wanted to thank our presenters. Looking forward to working collaboratively to fix our system so we can take care of our people. So with that, we are now adjourned. No further items.